Thank you. It's an honor to be here. Fred, you've been coming since 1996.
Yes,
I think some others have too, so bless you. It's wonderful to see old friends and new faces as well. We're doing this month a series of four Thursday meetings on a single topic, a little minor topic called Master Your Mind. And this is the second of our meetings. And I'd like to start, for those of you who may not have been here last week, just to summarize just a little bit about what we said last week and how we're going to be continuing this week. So I'd like to just do a little bit of a summary. I gave us homework to do, and I hope to hear some from people who have done the homework. There's no quiz. And then I'd like to talk about what we might practice over the coming week, and then to come back and share. So this subject of mastering our minds, I took from a passage of the Buddha, a very famous passage of the Buddha, who says, just have some sense of the significance of this. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows, like a never-departing shadow. There's another translation of the same passage which goes even further and says, with our minds we make our world. We're actually creating our reality out of our minds. Most people don't understand that. Most people feel that their reality is presented to them in external circumstances. And it's a really a transformative and an immensely empowering thing to realize we do create our reality. And then the question is, do we want to create a reality that perpetuates misery and suffering, or do we want to create a reality that really brings happiness to ourselves and happiness to others? It's really that fundamental a question. And really the tools that the Buddha gives us and that we're talking about in the course of these 4 weeks, the Buddha gives us the tools to create a reality that brings us deeper and deeper forms of happiness. And I think it's important for us to remember, even though most of the language of what we talk about in these 4 weeks is about working with our own psyches, with working with our own minds, to remember that this has a really important collective meaning as well. All institutions come out of the human mind. So, the institution of capital punishment comes out of the human mind, for example. Just one little example. The institution of war comes out of the human mind. The institution of cooperation and peacefulness also comes out of the human mind. You see, we organize collectively by projecting our mind states into our institutions. It's like it's almost as if they're congealed or solidified qualities of mind. So Wall Street, you can think what possible mind state might be associated with Wall Street. I'm not gonna suggest it. So it's really important for us, not only individually, but it's really entirely important in terms of what reality we want to create collectively. And I think it's really important because our reality comes out of our minds. There's a way in which, and I think that we can often feel really overwhelmed and despairing when we look at our world And some of us feel like our world in many ways has gone severely awry. We look at it and we feel hopeless. As soon as we realize that all of this is not fixed in stone, you know, this building was created, and once it was created, it's more or less in place. But our institutions actually can be changed, and are and the reality that we create moment to by moment in our minds can be shifted and changed for us individually, but it's also true for us collectively. So this is a really consequential subject. And I mentioned last week that in order to master our minds, it's really important for us to, really getting down into the details here, it's really important for us to watch three things happening, and they're happening in every moment of our lives, every conscious moment of our lives. Essentially, it's the very complex and subtle interactions of our physical experience, our emotions, and our thoughts. And that's pretty much what we're investigating and working with in the course of this month. So last week, I suggested and I talked about the importance of us grounding our awareness in our physical bodies. That the mind is really subtle and shifting, constantly subtle and shifting. It's very there aren't clear or distinct experiences in the mind. Everything kind of fuses and merges into each other. What's very beautiful about our physical experience is that the experience is grosser and more concrete. And so what we can do actually is to anchor our minds in our bodies. Each time we're aware of a physical sensation, we're anchoring our consciousness in our bodies. That's really important. If we try to master the mind just using the mind, it's going to be like getting lost in the funhouse mirrors. But if you come and you can be doing this even as I speak here, you can just keep coming back to the physical experience of your body sitting there. What does it feel like? We just have to feel these bodies. And in a sense, this is what contains our experience as we work with the mind. And we'll talk more about that as we go along. But one of the things, I basically suggested that we practice two things in the course of this week. One is to make an effort, if you could turn that off. That's okay. The first suggestion was for us to actually have an intention to be more aware of our physical experience. And this is not anything fancy. You know, it's about actually being present while you brush your teeth, for example. Being present while you open a door. What does it actually feel like to open a door? How many times have we actually showed up, you know, for opening a door? Or to what extent are we lost in a story? And so it's really training ourselves, or when we're walking, you know, the wonderful experience of actually being present for the experience of eating. You know, actually be present for taste and the sensations involved with eating. You know, we have a choice. We can eat our thoughts or we can eat our food. You know? And it's way more interesting and way more nourishing to eat our foods rather than eating our thoughts. But how often do we really... we've all had that wonderful experience of, you know, tasting a really fresh tangerine, for example. And just being there. Oh, wow. You have to be present. You have to know. You have to know what your experience is. So the one thing is simply making an effort to be more present for our physical experience in the course of the week. And then the second suggestion was most of those experiences are quite neutral and they don't feel very significant to us. But as we train ourselves to be more and more and more present for our physical sensations, moment by moment, then when something dramatic happens to us, we can actually ground our emotional experience in our physical bodies. And that's an extraordinarily important thing to do. So I gave the example last week, a dramatic example of someone I'd heard about in Española who had been working for years in a very stable situation for a business in Española. And a couple of Fridays ago, someone came in and said, "We've closed the business. Get your things and get out." And the boss didn't even show up to make that announcement. This woman was actually the only economic provider, the only breadwinner of her family. Her husband was out of work. So it was just saying, let's imagine ourselves in that situation. And it's very dramatic, but it happens to people. Dramatic things happen to people. You know, what are the emotions that we're likely to feel? What are the thoughts that we're likely to have? And is it possible to actually ground our experience in our bodies? What do the emotions feel like? And the degree to which we can actually anchor our experience physically, we don't get so lost and spun out in the thoughts and the emotions. Does this make sense? So that's the setup. And I said that, you know, if you want to just listen to a Dharma talk and then forget about the homework, you know, the talk may or may not have been so useful to you. But if you actually want to go out and practice this stuff and put it put it to work in terms of really changing your experience, then it might be more useful to you. And if no one has anything to share, then I'm happy to sit in awkward silence with you. So anyone have anything to share, please?
I have trouble sleeping, so I decided to practice awareness when I wake at 2 in the morning and watch my breathing. And of course, the thoughts come. And so I'm lying there, and the thought comes, "Oh, I need to update my will." Very useful thought. And I noticed that immediately my gut clenches and I'm wide awake. And this kept going on. It was just very interesting to me. I would have these, you know, disconcerting thoughts about what I couldn't possibly do at that moment, and my gut would clench and I would be wide awake.
Were you able to identify the anxiety that was involved there?
Yeah, like doing my will.
Yes.
Or, you know, a really crazy kind of thing. Uh-huh. I mean, they're middle of the night thoughts, you know.
Yes.
I've got to update my insurance.
there's a French philosopher of the 19th century. I can't remember which one it was. Who said, "In the dark night of the human soul, it is always 3 o'clock in the morning." So thank you. So it's just a very beautiful example of, because if you were actually able to feel that clench in your stomach,
yes,
there's a way in which you're not so lost in the mental experience. Does that make sense?
Yes.
That's great. Beautiful. Thanks so much. I saw a hand here.
One thing I often do to myself is wonder if I remembered to lock a door, you know. So the practice that I engaged in was every time I put my hand in my pocket to take the key out, I would feel the key and say to myself, "Key in hand." And by that step then, I would hopefully be mindful as I put the key and unlocked or locked the door. And it worked pretty well, except one time I'm house sitting for my next door neighbors, and it's really important to remember to lock their door. I stepped out and I looked up in the sky, and there was this crow that was just, very, very high up. It was just totally beautiful. I just watched him, and I had locked the door and walked halfway. And did I lock the door? No, because I was thinking about this beautiful crow. But mostly it worked. I mean, and it was really grounded in the sensation of holding the key in my hand. And whenever that happened, I said, "Key in hand." So I got the mind and the body to coordinate.
Wonderful.
That
thank you.
That worked pretty
good. That's great. For those of us who have aging brains, good touch. Thank you. Anything else to share? Please.
Well, I had the experience of walking away from here last Thursday in somebody else's shoes.
Oh, there we are. Are you going to make the trade tonight? Oh, great.
Well, wake up and find someone else's shoes in my bedroom.
Walked away in somebody else's shoes, and I didn't know whose shoes they were, was that when I went outside, my shoes were not there. So I saw another pair of shoes that looked very much like mine from the rear. And they were the right size, so I assumed that it must be the shoes of the person who's wearing mine. And it was right after the homework was given. So I was very attentive to the experience of wearing these shoes, which were the right size, but had, you know, raised places, slightly different places. At the same time, I was aware of feeling the irony of it, a little distressed that I didn't have my shoes, that I had these other shoes that I wasn't used to, and hoping that we could, whoever it was, we could make the reverse exchange tonight.
I'm glad you both came back, and what a beautiful, what a beautiful example. So what I'm hearing from you is that you did exactly what I was suggesting. You had the physical experience of being in different shoes, but you also noticed the emotional response to the situation, and you probably watched a little bit the thought process associated with it. Is that right? Fantastic. It may seem small, an incident like that, but it's actually really significant. Because that was a little disturbing to lose your shoes and be in someone else's, walking in someone else's shoes.
Unpredicted and disoriented.
Yes, but being able to show up for that kind of experience, a minor challenge, is really, it's essentially what you're doing is training your mind to be more and more ready to show up for the major challenges when they come, and they come for all of us.
I know.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Please.
I've come up with another way of doing meditation besides sitting, standing, walking. I'm doing swimming meditation. I'm swimming mindfully.
Wonderful, wonderful.
I figured that's okay.
Oh, yeah. It's like the Buddha said that there are basically four postures, standing, sitting, walking, and lying down. And we can add a fifth now. of swimming. I have a friend who's a very active swimmer, and he does, that's the major part of his practice, and he has a deep practice.
Oh, wow.
So, he does not only mindfulness, but he also sends metta. He'll do a lap sending metta to one particular person in his life, and then he'll send metta to the Dalai Lama, and it's just
that sounds like
you
a
can
thing
to do. Riff with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
Thank you.
Do hot tubs count?
Yeah, they count. Sure. Please.
My experience is a little bit different. I was checking out the body and going into meditation in the morning, and it was wonderful, beautiful. I was right there, the whole thing, wonderful. Ring, 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 and it's a friend of mine on the phone, and hello, what you doing? I'm meditating. Oh, really? Oh, well, what's happened? That damn guy at the post office, I paid my dues, and he said I didn't, and I didn't get the receipt. And it's a federal offense. And I know, oh, boy, this is going to go on for a half hour. Just like that a few days before. And I, it was nice. I handled it gently and everything else. Okay, but I couldn't get back because the committee started in the brain. Just couldn't do it. I kept, this thing kept coming. I should be able to sit down and get all this back together and go back to the space I was in, the mind space. I couldn't get there, though. I was agitated, and I had things to do, and blah, blah, all that stuff. So, anyway, you know, the next day was okay.
Thank you. Thanks. Please.
Well, it was interesting to do this exercise because I realized how much my sort of imagination can create all of these sort of scary situations that then, of course, lead me to be very fearful. And then, you know, I have this just visceral reaction to it. You know, my body just tenses up and my stress level goes up considerably, my heart rate and all of that. And so I guess I have more of a question for you, and that is, when that happens, is the point of focusing on your body to sort of see the deleterious effect on your body and therefore you realize that it's kind of stupid to have, or that it's not useful to have those types of thoughts and to stop having those thoughts? Is that kind of the concept?
Well, I think that, and I'll talk about this today or in either the third or the fourth Thursday. But essentially what the Buddha is saying is if you want to be free, he said, strengthen the wholesome qualities of consciousness. Fred was talking about generosity, for example. It's a very beautiful quality. It makes us happy to be generous. And reduce and eventually uproot the unwholesome qualities of consciousness that are afflictive to us. So fear and anxiety, this is afflictive. There's no judgment involved. You know, it's not about, in a sense, it's not about resisting it, but if you observe the painful experience that fear brings, and you just described it very well, you know, the heart rate, all of that. So you're able to observe the actual impact of fear on the body, and you're able to notice that the fear projects something into the future. Well, the future doesn't exist. It's only a projection. So if we're able to see, and here it is, the interaction of these three things, just as you've described it, there's the physical experience, which is influenced by the mind. There's the emotion, which is running the whole show. And then there's the story associated with it. And normally what we do is we get lost in the story. And then we believe the story. Even though the future isn't here, even though this thing may or may not ever happen, we get lost in the story, we believe it. We've created a reality. We've created a world that isn't serving us. So if you're able to see that, oh, this is painful. This is fantasy. You know, this is not helping me physically. Then there's some way in which there's a willingness to let the fear go. You know, and if that is a deep habit of fear coming up and projecting a situation, it may take a lot of observation. But if you can just keep showing up for it, the Buddha said to slay the dragon, you only have to name it. And what we're doing is not only naming it, but we're feeling it. We're feeling the dragon, fear, in our bodies, you know, your experience. You feel it. You name it, you feel it, you name it, and at some point it begins to lose its power. Because fear only works if it's like, you know, sitting on your shoulder and whispering into your ear. But as soon as you turn toward and say, fear, I know you. I know your stories. It begins to lose its power. So it's a very beautiful example. Thank you. That's great. Please.
The thing that I took away most from what you said last week was that we do feel these emotions right in the core of the body, but we don't feel them in other parts of the body. And so I resolved that every time one of them came up, I would think about my shoulder and see what happened. And I found that especially for those 3 a.m. Bouts of anger and anxiety and fear, that worked really well. I would just say, oh yes, my shoulder is angry, and you know, I feel my breath, and now I feel fine. And it worked in traffic as well. I would be stopped behind one of these monster trucks with one of the blood pressure raising bumper stickers. Look, there's my shoulder. It's feeling good. So it was, that worked very well for me.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you. That's and I'll be talking more about that. Next week I'm going to be talking more about working specifically with the emotions. And so I'll be talking more about the experience of strength or neutrality, which isn't involved with it, and actually being with the painful sensations associated with an emotion. So thank you for that. Please.
I thought I had totally forgotten about the assignment. And then something that was for me very significant happened as a result of it, and then I forgot that happened. I have a memory problem. I think it was a couple nights later, I was sitting at home. I have trouble doing things when I get home late at night, and I'm a late night person, and I work late hours compared to most people generally. And I just avoid doing things. I'm aware of that. And I do things that they're kind of wholesome, but they're distractions. And I decided that I was just going to stop and, you know, feel what's happening, what it is that I want to avoid now. I mean, that's how I conceptualized it. And I'm there, and something I've been reading conditioned this. It was a familiar feeling. It's a chronic feeling. It's a feeling that goes back to early childhood. But I never had a label for it, except I was looking at a list of symptoms of PTSD, and one of them was feelings of impending doom. And I'd never, you know, I felt this so often, but it was helpful, first of all, to have a label to put to it. And I just continued to sit there, and I started looking around just at different things in the room that I was, just getting my attention out, and started to reflect that there's nothing threatening happening right now. And it was really a powerful experience.
You've just described the process that is used in many therapeutic traditions. You know, you feel the emotion, the sense of impending doom, we could call it dread. Mm-hmm. You felt the feeling, and then you oriented yourself in the present. And the healing comes, the healing of trauma comes in part when we have one foot in the past and one foot in the present. You know, so you're feeling the feelings associated with the past, but you're not lost in them. Orienting yourself to the present moment and realizing there's no doom here, that is actually a healing moment. It's really deconditioning the feeling of impending doom. Mm-hmm. So beautiful, just
thank
beautiful.
You.
Hey, it was worth coming last week all the way from Embudo to hear these stories. It's very beautiful. Wow. One more, please.
I turned several days of being snowbound into a very interesting experience, and all the while keeping very purposefully in mind home. And
if you could project your voice. Thanks.
I have a very bad voice, and I'll get dizzy if I talk to
you. Okay,
me.
Okay. So
but I'll try.
Sorry, just hold it. It's fine.
Okay. So Friday... last Friday, I went to a store to buy some things, and actually a nursery. And I made a comment about a certain plant that I liked very much, a rose bush that I liked a lot. And a woman asked me where I was from, and we started talking about this particular type of rose bush. And then the woman at the cash register said, "Well, I'm from the same town that you're from," and because I identified where my, I'm kind of trying to abbreviate this, and now I'm taking up time. So, anyway, the woman at the cash register discovered that we were from the same town. She asked me what high school I went to, and I told her, and she went to the same high school. And she asked for my name, and we exchanged names. And I thought that I recognized her maiden name, but I wasn't sure, and I didn't want this recognition that I thought occurred to be introduced into the conversation. And so I kept thinking about this woman and myself being from the same high school, and I went to a bookshelf and took down a book, thinking that I might find her maiden name in that book. Well, I spent 3 days reading this book, and I hate this particular book. And I'm not sure whether it's one, two, the third time that I've read it. And the reason I hate it is because it details in, I don't know, almost 400 pages, some a terrible epic in the town that I grew up in. And I knew some of the main characters in high school, and I only knew them peripherally, although we did say hello to each other in the hall and use our names, but I was afraid to associate with them, and I'm sure glad that I was. But as I read the book, I purposefully watched my response to this story, and I could feel myself glowing. And when I experience anxiety or anger or disgust or any negative emotion, I feel my head and my face, my jaw, my chest and stomach glow. And it's almost as if there is heat coming from it. And I would, of course, identify the feeling and attach it to the occurrence being spoken of in the book. And I would rest from that, and I would watch my thought pattern, and it always went to, this is where you came from, this is what you escaped, this is what was all around you, and look at the immorality and the complete disregard for ethics and for family and community and self that the story was speaking. And so after I penetrated that and allowed myself to really examine my response to what to the narrative, and really penetrate the narrative and the truth of what was being said, because I knew the truth, because I was never involved, but I knew people that were, and they reported to me inadvertently, purposefully, because it had it was thought of as very glamorous. Very perverted form of glamour, I have to say. And so each time I really go deeply into it, I would realize you're being affected by something that had nothing directly to do with you. And it is from 30 years ago. And you have three times tortured yourself reading this garbage. And why do you continue to try to get the story exactly straight and identify who you really did have an acquaintance with? And why are you living in the past? And why are you letting the past affect you viscerally? And what does this do to you, to your thought processes? And because all of my thoughts during that Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, 4 days, all of my thoughts were consumed by that book. Even when the book was sitting on the floor and I was cooking supper or whatever. So I was actually seeing my past that no longer exists and that didn't exist after it was over, moment by moment, controlling my thoughts, my feelings, and I watched myself not really tie into the emotions that were generated because I didn't purposefully try to anesthetize myself, but I knew that I wasn't. See, now I'm saying I'm wrong. You had a very emotional response, but I tried at the time to not have an emotional response, and now I'm realizing I did have a full three experiences that you asked us to pay attention to.
And I think if you reflect that you were able to watch the physical experience, you were able to watch the emotional experience, to identify the emotional experience, you were able to watch the story, and then you brought wisdom to bear to say, this doesn't exist anymore. It's the wisdom that slices through and actually begins to free us. So I think that's a very beautiful example of simply saying, okay, it was dramatic, it brought up a whole bunch of feelings, I'm going through this for the third or fourth time, and I can let the past go. And that doesn't mean that those feelings won't come up again if they're strong enough, but there's this moment of freeing the mind. Does that make sense? That's great. Thank you. Thanks so much. I'd like to just to suggest what we might do over the next... Sandy, did you... Yeah?
I have something to...
Yeah, please, share, and then I'll...
I'll try and keep it brief. I experienced a couple of things. One was basically your example of eating your thoughts. I was at a restaurant that's a little nicer than the kind of restaurant I usually patronize, and they had a really delicious dessert on the menu, which I ordered. And I started to eat the dessert, and after I had about three bites, I suddenly realized that I was tasting it in my mind. I wasn't even paying attention really to the taste of it. I was just looking at it and thinking, this is really delicious, without really tasting it. And
beautiful.
So, fortunately, I noticed that before I finished it. And I started focusing on the actual taste of it. And as you say, the food tastes better than your thoughts. I got something out of that. And the other thing, which I think is going to help me more long term, is several times during the week I noticed myself becoming impatient while I was doing something. I I had something that I was looking forward to doing, but I had to do something else first. And and I started thinking to myself, well, that impatience is something that's going on in my mind, but it's not going on in my body. Because I would look, I sort of, you know, did a body check sort of thing, and I realized that my body wasn't impatient. My body was just doing whatever I was doing. It was perfectly happy with the current status of things. And it was just within my mind that I had these ideas that, oh, I wish this were over so I could do the next thing. I wish this were over so I could do the next thing. And so, again, by focusing on the body, I was able to get a lot more control over those thoughts of being impatient.
Thank you. Thank you for both of those examples. I'm just thinking that when there's that sense of impatience, there's almost a sense as if the body is tipping forward. You know, and by coming back to your body and realizing your body wasn't tipping forward, only the mind was, you're suddenly not tipping forward anymore, even for just an instant. Thank you. Thanks for that example. So I'd like to suggest what we might focus on for this next week. And I'd like to suggest that we actually do this in a cumulative way. So please feel free to continue to cultivate awareness of your body over the next week. It's really essentially what we're doing is we're learning to anchor our experience in our bodies. And I can't emphasize too much how important that is, because it really helps us to keep from being lost or spun out. So please continue to do just as you have been reporting here, is to experience whatever's going on in your body, to notice that. But I'd like for us, if it seems okay to you, for the next week to really start to pay some attention to our thoughts. And to do a little bit of discernment. You know, we can't stop our thoughts. So it's not about resisting our thoughts. This species is Homo sapiens, right? What we do is think. And thank heavens we can think. It's a wonderful quality that we humans have. But it is really useful to notice when we are mastering our thoughts, that is when we're using thoughts intentionally. Okay, now I need to think about this. I'm focusing my mind on this. I'm using this brain. And when our thoughts are actually mastering us. You know, where our thoughts are carrying us somewhere where we don't necessarily want to go. Can you see that distinction? You know, thought is a very beautiful tool, and it gets us into enormous difficulty if we're not very clear about what thinking is useful to us and actually what thinking can be harmful to us. So here's a suggestion. Is that you actually notice the contents of your thoughts. You know, so someone described that there's a habit, there can be a habit of anxiety. You know, we all have different, we're constituted in different ways. In Buddhist psychology, they describe three character types, you know, and we all have three qualities, but they're the three root tormentors of our minds. There's the greedy mind, there's the aversive mind, and there's the delusive mind. and so, you know, some of us are more drawn to desire, and we want things that are beautiful, and we walk into a room, we see everything that's beautiful. Some of us are aversive, we walk into the room and we find everything that's wrong. And then the deluded type walks into a room and doesn't notice much of anything. So we all have different habits of mind, and it's really useful to see those habits. Please, you have a question?
I do. How does that relate to the story?
Well, essentially is that our minds are constantly telling stories.
Yes.
And so and essentially the question is, are those stories wholesome? Are they reinforcing things that bring us happiness and well-being? Mm-hmm. Just for example, loving kindness. The Buddha defined loving kindness as seeing the essential goodness of beings and wishing for their well-being. this is a good thing to do. And so if you're having loving thoughts, I really like that person, I appreciate their kindness, you know, I really wish them well, I hope, you know, I hope the wedding goes well, you know, whatever. That is a good story. And it's really good to support stories like that. Or really, the Buddha says, celebrate your good deeds. Celebrate your own goodness. And if you really help somebody out, to step back instead of just moving on to the next thing and say, that was a good thing to do. I'm really glad I did that. You know, it brings a sense of worthiness, which is actually really wholesome. So to notice the wholesome stories, support them. Run the stories. But to notice we all have stories that actually reinforce afflictive qualities of consciousness. You know, so that kind of aching, grasping greed that we can feel. I need that, I want it, and I'll never be happy until I have it. Or I hate that person. You know, and it's so useful. You know, again, this is, we're talking mostly intrapsychically, we're about working with our own minds, but it is so useful to turn on the television and notice what stories are being poured into our psyches every day. You know, it can be extreme things like Beck, what's his first name, that crazy guy, Glenn Beck. So it can be extreme stories like Glenn Beck, but even the subtle ones. Notice, what are they reinforcing in us, these stories? Because I have post-traumatic stress disorder, I don't go to violent movies. And I just can't believe, and I don't actually have a television, but when I turn on the television, I cannot believe how much violence there is. It's astonishing to me. And what is that doing to us? What are those public stories doing to us? What are the political stories doing to us? You know, so it's noticing the stories that we run in our own minds, but our minds are not separate. Our minds interpenetrate. And so our story is influencing the people around us, immediately around us, and the public stories are creating a mass consciousness, a mass reality, a mass world that we're creating out of our minds. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So the first thing is to notice, What are the stories that are good to run, and what are the stories that are afflictive, and to notice them and to decide whether you want to keep running them. And mostly we have such habituation is that we run those unwholesome stories all the time and we don't notice what we're doing to ourselves. So this week is about noticing what we're doing to ourselves. That's the content of our thoughts and our stories. I think it is also useful to step back a little bit and to see the process of thinking. So it's not about the content of the story, but it's really to notice. It's to notice what does thought do to us, and where do thoughts come from? Where do they go? How much substance do they have? What do they weigh? What's their color? What's their form? You know, you really look at it, my God, they are so unbelievably insubstantial, and yet they run our lives. No, to really notice how insubstantial they are, to really step back and say, oh, that was a thought? You know, and how long do they last? You know, a thought is gone almost as soon as you notice that it has happened. You know, so please, another.
Well, isn't that where stories come in? You give them substance.
Right.
The story. You have this thought.
Right.
And then you elaborate on it. It's like pouring gas on a fire.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's called papancha. It's called proliferation. Oh, okay. And so we can pay attention to the content and notice what we're proliferating. But I think it's also really useful to get some sense about what thoughts are and to notice, are they really substantial? Do we want to give them that much importance? And then to notice also that what happens to our experience if we stay in the mode of thinking essentially we're in the mode of concepts and words. Concepts and words are useful, but they can't take us deep into our experience. So if you're always here, you'll never get here. And I gave the example last week of something that has become so profound for me, is that I can step out of my house, because I live in a very beautiful natural area. I can step out of my house, I can look up at the snow-covered mountains, and I can actually almost hear, audibly hear, the earth saying, just open and I will heal you. Now, if I'm staying in my obsessions and my stories and my thoughts, I'm not going to have any idea that the earth is there wanting to heal me. But if I can let those, if I can just hit a spacious place, let the thoughts go, and just open up, I can feel the power and the healing coming into me. So do you see? If I stay on the level of thought, I'll never have that experience. This happens to us all the time. And so it can be really useful to see, is it possible to let some of this go and to experience something more deeply? You know, so Ralph Waldo Emerson said, he said, life consists of what somebody is thinking about all the time. So the first thing is about the contents, you know, what are you thinking about all the time? And is that really what you want to be thinking about? And then on this deeper level, can we go to a deeper level of reality just by letting the thoughts go occasionally? So Krishnamurti, J. Krishnamurti said, life begins where thought ends. You know, are you willing to experience that life? Essentially, that all that richness of life is essentially not available to us because we're just caught in this superficial level of experience. And I just want to end this with the words of Bankei, a great 17th century Zen teacher from Japan. He said his whole teaching was about the experience of the unborn, that is, of coming to a very profound level of experience, which is whole and undivided, and which is not born and doesn't die, and that's essentially what we are. So his whole teaching is about the unborn. Experience the unborn. Experience it for yourself. It's another way of saying nirvana or God or whatever you want to call it. He said, I was still a young man when I came to discover the principle of the unborn and its relation to thought. I began to tell others about it. What we call a thought, quote unquote, is something that has already fallen one or more removes from the living reality of the unborn. So we don't try to get rid of our thoughts. We can't. But what we can do is that if we pull our attention away from thinking, away from the story, and we open to our experience, it could be to the level of our emotions. You know, very often our emotions run our thoughts. We're focused on the story. We don't even notice the emotion, the anxiety, you know, that's projecting some awful future or a sense of doom. If we can let the thoughts go and feel our way down into the emotional level, we're working at the level, a more primary level of cause rather than the level of effect. The thoughts are the effect. The emotions are the cause. And there can be times when you go even beyond the emotions to experience something else, which can be very deep. And so it really is consequential. So my suggestion is stay with physical experience, you know, cultivate physical experience. You've reported beautifully this way of seeing the interrelationships of the physical experience, the emotional experience, and the thought experience, to see how they influence each other. Continue to do that, but also give particular attention to one of these three things that we're working with, that is with the thinking, with thought. Does that make sense? Is that useful? Okay. Well, thank you so much, friends.
Thank you.